Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 83 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling WSU's Spring Wheat Breeding Philosopher, Mike Pumphrey. About my conversation with the College of Agriculture and Human and Natural Resource Sciences Assistant Professor at Washington State University. I like Pumphrey. He reminds me of a scientific me, a man who, by and large, keeps his head down and does his work without a lot of fanfare, but one hopes positive results. He's also a fellow who thinks a lot. As a younger man who was told I think too much, there's a negative association to the activity if it becomes obsessive, but a lot of positive associations as well. For me, thinking is like my own personal Rubik's Cube. I'm always turning my thoughts this way and that. I think my way into a story or this podcast. It's also just the way I am, and I suspect the way Pumphrey is too. It had been more than a month since my June 5th, 2018 interview with Pumphrey when I finally found the time to produce this podcast. Although I remembered I had enjoyed the interview, I had forgotten the details of our conversation in his Johnson Hall office. So I was happily surprised to find in listening to the interview that my questions and Pumphrey's answers tended to be both about the specifics of his program and the bigger thoughts about the process of wheat breeding and what it means to be a plant breeder. Which is why I'm entitling the first part of my interview with him, Mike Pumphrey, WSU Spring Wheat Breeding Philosopher. You'll hear a side of him here that's not on display at the innumerable field days he attends. Next week, episode 84 will conclude my conversation with Pumphrey, looking more closely at the specifics of the work he does. Creatively stitching together a podcast occasionally requires a heads up from my audience. In this case, that's because a question about facultative wheat, that is, spring wheat which is planted in the late fall or even winter, led into a more philosophical discussion about climate change. The nuts and bolts discussions on facultative wheat is in part two. Here, Pumphrey observes in more general terms what scientists have found with regard to a rise in temperatures and what is his response. I interviewed Pumphrey for the magazine Wheat Life shortly after he arrived in Pullman 8 years ago. As a kid growing up in a small Oklahoma town where neither of his parents were involved in agriculture, he told me it was the father of a friend who first instilled in him a wonder for the plant world. The father worked for the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and he taught Pumphrey the names of weeds. Interestingly, Pumphrey's PhD isn't in plant breeding. It's in plant pathology with a focus on molecular biology. He was a research geneticist working for the Agricultural Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture when WSU hired him as the university's spring wheat breeder. In an earlier conversation I had with Pumphrey, he told me that being a wheat breeder was a noble profession. I asked him what he meant by that.
Oh, this gets into the philosophy of wheat breeding, huh? In my years growing up working on wheat, researching wheat, I've become more and more fond. I mean, you can look at old biblical references or medieval references to bread or wheat being the staff of life. Socrates says that nobody can be a true statesman unless they understand the problems of wheat. Jonathan Swift says whoever can grow two blades of grass where only one grew before has done more for mankind than anybody else. So it's just those sort of romantic ideas. It's just about using science, using the technology, using knowledge available to improve things. And, you know, a wheat breeder has to be knowledgeable of natural resources, of environmental stewardship, of trade policies, of genetics, of statistics, of policy, of environmental science, you know, it's of nutrition, of food security. All these things are wrapped into just trying to make a plant look better out in the field in Whitman County. Is that pretentious enough for you?
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. You once referred to something called a breeding brain. What is a breeding brain?
most of us that end up in this line of work tend to be really good with memory and numbers and sort of visual numeric associations. So I can walk in the field, and the first thing I don't think about is oh, that's green or that's blue. I think that looks like this WA, blah, 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 blah. So there's a sort of database of recollections in your brain. So the same thing happens when you sit and analyze data day in and day out. You really get those line numbers, those pedigrees, those names just burned in your brain of the type of traits they have, the things associated with those pedigrees. If you're practicing it and continuing it day in and day out, it sticks. And you know, instant recall, you can tell me a plot number, or not a plot number, but a plot identity, and I can kind of access my little neural network of all the trait data I've seen on that thing. And I don't have it all perfect in my head, but I can generally tell you what it is, why it's there, what it came from, what the overall traits of that type of material are. If I were to take a sabbatical for 4 years, I'm not sure I could tell you all those things mm-hmm. 4 years later.
Mm-hmm. When I am describing you, I describe you as a plant breeder and a geneticist. Which describes you better?
I actually like plant scientist. Mm. That's my, you know, my PhD is in plant pathology. So all the other breeders and geneticists around here probably have a PhD in breeding or genetics or agronomy or something. Mine's in plant pathology. Although I did work in wheat genetics as a plant pathology PhD student. I like plant scientists. You know, everything we do is not in a vacuum. It's not in a box. Every time I walk in the field, I have to think about the production system, the soil type there, the fertility, the water, the weather, the diseases, the other inputs, the herbicides, whatever. You know, you can't just walk into the field and think about one thing. So I think we are, at least a good breeder is probably a plant scientist first and maybe a geneticist second.
Does being a plant pathologist give you a different point of view?
Yeah, it definitely does. If you look at the type of research I do and peer-reviewed journal articles and those sort of things, the majority of it is in wheat disease-related research. Now, is that indicative of what I can do or what I am good at? Maybe not. It's just what comes most comfortable to me because of kind of how I was trained. I do have probably a stronger background in specific disease systems. So if there's particular diseases that are an issue in the Northwest, like rusts are a good example, I've kind of worked at rusts all around the world in different ways, and I understand rust pretty well. So I do probably approach the breeding for rust resistance in my own unique way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does success look like to you as a breeder and as a faculty member in the Department of Crop and Soils?
Well, you know, I don't really detach my personal life from work life, from being an instructor, and it's really just to be a good citizen, be positive, be impactful, be productive, be considerate, just basically be good.
Yeah, that's a good one, be good. You like being part of the university. I've talked to you about this before. Rather than working for a private company, what is it about a university that attracts you?
I like science. I like research. I like sharing information in a peer-reviewed way around the world. I like teaching. I really enjoy teaching. It's tough to balance all these things, and that's increasingly the challenge, not just for myself, for every person in crop and soil sciences at this university, is balancing the efforts on teaching, extension, research in a productive way, in a healthy way. So I like the overall land-grant mission. I like teaching, extension, research.
In a story I wrote a couple of years ago for Wheat Life, when Washington State University released its 100th variety, you suggested that WSU may never make it to 200 released varieties. Why?
I think we have to be mindful of changes in consolidation in the industry and technology, in where our investments go in public research versus private companies. I in particular technology, from the breeding and genetics world, you can look at vegetable seed crops, you can look at corn and soybeans, cotton. The reality in all of those already is that a very limited number of seed companies pretty much run the show. And I wouldn't say run it, they compete, it's healthy. But there's not a whole lot of room for individual small public efforts to have the sort of impact that wheat breeding at public institutions has historically had. Every other crop shows that a different model has evolved, and I'd be surprised if we are the one to buck the trend, and we could be. At Washington State, we're still very commercially relevant. We work hard to fulfill growers' needs. I'm proud of that, and I truly believe in it. I still find it hard to believe that I'm going to have a successor that's doing the same thing 40 years from now or 60 years from now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you think GMOs are still going to be a game changer in wheat, or has that boat sailed?
I think eventually, I guess it depends these days what we call a GMO, and if we're talking about specifically a gene added from a foreign organism, but I definitely think things like CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing, other evolving gene editing tools, RNA silencing, all these things are going to have a major impact in plants in general, in plant production specifically. And I don't think the ship has sailed now. We've had growing and growing stockpiles. We have a storage or production of wheat that's record highs with carryovers at record highs. That's not always going to be the case. And when it's not the case, those tools are going to get implemented, in my opinion.
What's your gut tell you? Could we have done facultative wheat 30 years ago, or has the climate changed to make it more possible?
It's definitely getting more feasible by the year. With average temperatures being higher, I think Washington, we probably had record summer heat, three or four out of the past 5 years, something like that. If I remember hearing the reports correctly, that's for spring wheat. That's not necessarily a good thing. Winter wheat is the keystone crop here. It's still very well adapted. Heat will or does affect winter wheat, but spring wheat's more vulnerable. And so by making it spring wheat more like winter wheat, you're putting it into that growing time that it is happier, less heat during grain fill, and presumably more moisture availability at that time too.
And we're also getting these spring and early summer rains that it didn't seem like we had before.
Yeah, those benefit both. Probably it depends on the year which one gets the most benefit, I would guess. This year is a good example that the way the conditions were coming out of the winter, I thought we'd be seeding in this sort of core spring wheat country sooner than we did. But we got some of those late spring rains that actually slowed us down. That's not a good thing. The earlier we can plant, the better. The winter wheat, though, looks phenomenal around here, and that's because it was ready and waiting for that moisture and takes advantage of every drop of it as it comes.
You mentioned that it's getting hotter. Are you breeding for a hotter climate? The Climate Impact Group said temperatures in the state increased 1.5 degrees through the 20th century. It's also predicting shorter springs and a Columbia Basin that's 5 degrees hotter by 2050. Is that information influencing your breeding efforts?
We've definitely had significant grant federally funded research in this area where we intentionally plant things at the wrong times, manage them in specific ways to try to really mimic the extremes of what we might expect. We've done that kind of genetic analysis. We've explored different ways to phenotype and select for those varieties grown in those different conditions. Actively, no. Research, yes. But has that changed today how we plant our trials, how we measure our trials for breeding purposes? The answer is no. But that's why you start with basic research and develop it over decade or more, two or three, and then you're ready to apply it when you need it. Thing about breeding and the beauty of it is that we're breeding not in a vacuum. We're not breeding in the weather 30 years ago. So am I doing something about warmer springs? If the spring's warmer, I'm selecting for performance under a warmer spring. If earlier maturity or shorter growing season's important, the simplest thing we can do, and I continue to do, and I love the quote, is just weigh the bag. And it's expensive to weigh the bag from a breeding standpoint. And by that, I mean harvest a full plot with a combine and see how it did. But breeding is not done in a vacuum. You're selecting, you know, so the past 10 years, if it's been getting warmer, I've been selecting yield based on how it was. And with that change, long-term, it might be really neat to, if you could do some sort of fair historical comparison of have they really changed and adapted to those different conditions. And is that why? But for now, we're not breeding in a vacuum. We're breeding and adapting every cycle, every year, based on the conditions in the field.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Syngenta says it's going to come out with a hybrid by 2020. How might that change your program? Is the university, is your program, going to get in the hybrid game?
If it makes sense and we have access and it's what is best for the growers, then it's what we'll do. A lot of the sort of challenge of hybrid wheat breeding is in identifying and developing the heterotic patterns or the parents that are going to cross really well and do well in combination in the hybrid. That is a long-term expensive endeavor. You could ask Syngenta. They've invested a lot of money over the past decade in doing just those sort of experiments. We tend to run a lot closer to the margins of just doing what we can do to release varieties right now. And so am I ready to develop hybrid wheats? The answer is no. I don't have appropriate germplasm bases assembled, tested, and heterotic patterns identified. And it would take me 5 years to do just an initial look at something like that. And so it's not going to be immediate if that is the direction we do go. Now, we do have projects kind of related to hybrid production. I have some collaborations related to actual sterility systems and hybrid detection systems and cross-pollination systems. So we have an interest in hybrid wheat science and research, but it's not part of our applied breeding process at this time.
It's been suggested that genomic information used in wheat could herald a breakthrough in improving the efficiency of breeding. How has big data, meaning this genomic information, changed your program?
You know, to be fair, I do have long-term optimism, and I've already mentioned genomic selection as one of those tools that we're kind of betting hard on in the future to speed up the breeding process and the quality of selections. How has genomic data changed my program to date? I would say it's changed which parents I choose and how I choose my parents. It has not fundamentally changed the breeding process at this point. I think the greatest promise is when it actually changes the breeding process. And by that, I mean when we start going in and repeatedly looking at the genomic marker profiles of these lines in early generations to select and fix those positive things early on. For now, like I said, what I do is I use that type of information to select what I feel are the best parents. And after that, we do it pretty much the old way.
How does this genomic information help you identify the best parents?
Multiple things. One is while we're doing all the DNA isolation and marker genotyping, I can get a comprehensive look at all the different alleles that it has for traits that I know about that are important in the region. Also, because we've been able to genotype large panels of elite lines, we can predict the breeding values of those lines. So this is synonymous with how they use genomics information in, say, cattle breeding or horse breeding or swine breeding. And that is, you genotype the individual, you measure the performance of the offspring, and then you're able to predict which ones are the better parents.
Would the breeders of 30 years ago recognize breeding today?
Yeah, they would recognize every part of the process. They would kind of roll their eyes or scoff while trusting the statistical genetic side of things, because those tools simply were not available. The statistical models were not invented. The genotyping platforms did not exist. But it would probably only take about 1 hour for them to then think of applications far better than my brain can come up with, because there were things that puzzled or riddled them their whole careers that they could never go after directly that they probably could today. So I think, yes, they would definitely recognize the process. Most of our field and greenhouse efforts are the same. It's just the supporting information that's changed.
Well, it almost seems to me like they were in a room without any light, and you are in a room that has light.
Yeah. And there's, you know, that's why there's a value in a diversity in the workforce and having these sort of generational differences and discussing these things openly with people at different levels of their understanding and career, so that the light shines everywhere, I guess.
So that the light shines everywhere. Perhaps when all is said and done, that sums up Pumphrey's attraction to serving at a university rather than a private company. Universities are intended exactly for the purpose of spreading the light, which harkens back to the wheat-breeding philosopher's opening explanation about the noble profession. I hate to be a broken record here, folks, but we've reached a listenership plateau. Yes, there's been a healthy gain in listeners since the weekly podcast went live in January 2017, and I'm grateful to every one of you who tunes in on a regular basis. But there are so many more potential listeners out there. For instance, I was at the Wilkie Farm Field Day and ran into Jim Walesby, who served on the Washington Wheat Commission when I was a reporter with Capital Press. Yeah, he'd heard about the podcast, but he hadn't gotten around to listening. I asked for his phone, an iPhone, found the Purple Podcast app, typed Wheat All About It in the Finder, and voila, there it was. He was grateful, and I was thrilled another listener had joined the podcast parade. So whether you are physically taking friends' phones out of their hands or communicating with the folks who make up your Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter universe, please make sure they understand that Wheat All About It exists and that they should listen to it if they want to better understand this wonderful wheat industry of ours. Please join me again next week for episode 84, or what I'm calling WSU's Spring Wheat Breeder, Plant Scientist, Geneticist, Plant Pathologist, and Professor, Mike Pumphrey, on Wheat All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.